Okay, this is Bob and Karen again. Bob and Cameron. Bob and Cameron McEwen. And we're doing our 13th episode on my book, on pamphlet book that is titled, what is it titled? Let's see.
What We Didn't Know About Trump.
Thank you. What we, you, I haven't looked at it in a while, okay. What we/you didn't know about Trump. Okay. Now we, in this, our 13th episode, the first 12, we wandered into looking at my charts, the Dobbs formula chart and the tiny note chart, which comes out of the Bob Dobbs formula chart. And Cameron suggested that we listen to his translation of what I've done up to this point, what he thinks I've been doing with my charts. Right, Cameron?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So I thought what I would do is sort of set out where I think we've been and where we may be heading. That is to say, we've been looking at your charts, and now we're going on to the tiny note chart, and we're sort of in between. We're just getting ready to get into the tiny note chart. And I noticed that the extreme right bottom of the tiny note chart, you refer to the formula chart, and you refer to holeopathic backspins, retrievals, and holeopathic cliche probes. And these are things that are fairly familiar to our discussions from the formula chart discussed in previous weeks. So my thought is that in moving on to the tiny note chart, we could kind of start from the bottom right. Instead of starting from the very top, we might start from the bottom right, which ties back to the formula chart, and understand how the bottom right kind of envelops the rest. Now, that suggestion could be completely wrong, in which case you should reject it. But I think the advantage of that is that it then brings some of the ideas from the formula chart that I liked into a way to appreciate the tiny note chart. And what I took from the formula chart and what I liked is that, number one, it was an example of thinking, right? It was a mind engaged in shuffling ideas in attempt to try to come to grips with our crazy reality. And it introduced ideas, for example, a kind of knot of time, K-N-O-T, of time, that is helpful in trying to break with Gutenberg thinking. In the charts, effects can come before causes. Effects and causes can be knotted up together so that each can be before and after the other. And these notions of time and of cause and effect are additional ways of shuffling that I find interesting. Another thing I find interesting is that the thinking is outside the box, not only outside of academic thinking, but outside of most other thinking on the planet, in that you don't accept beings as being obvious things that are either walking around as humans or as plants or as manufactured things. I mean, the obvious groups of beings are thought to be sort of limited classifications, and that thinking has to be able to shuffle our whole notion of what it means to be. And I think that's also helpful. And then the last thing I'd mention is that we agreed the last discussion that what's brought up in the charts isn't to be taken literally. What's going on is thinking that starts by being structural, and that the important thing is to understand the structures that are being shuffled, not to try to understand the meaning of a particular term or a particular name or something like that. And when I look at the tiny note chart, I mean, the most obvious thing about it is that it's impossible to say the 4 or 20 or 100 things that are being mentioned, because there's literally thousands of different things that's going on here, and the need is to understand why it was that you thought it necessary to range over this enormous variety as a way of continuing on that thought that you were doing, or that thinking, I should say, that you were doing in the charts.
Yes.
So I'll stop there, and you correct and augment.
No, that what you said is perfect so far. That's very good. You understand what I've said so far. To get to the bottom, which I would say is the Dobbs quadrant, and the important factor is the Rumpelstiltskin, but I would like to introduce the chart with the direction of getting to the fifth quadrant and Rumpelstiltskin as soon as possible. But I need to sort of lay out something here.
Sure.
At the very top, we've discussed a chain letter of phase shifts, the top sentence or phrase, and then the big sentence or title is Anachronous Bob's Tiny Note, which equals the Grand Wazoo's Decade Dance or Decadence. And then this chart is a visualization of a cyclotron of homeopathic cliche probes, which I've explained previously. And then underneath that, in the bracket, two brackets, it says causes merging with effects, and causes are in quotes. And that refers to the bottom of page 137 of Take Today, the executive as dropout. Okay, so then you come across four strange words, Rai, Eloy, to Lofty, and then Bob. So these indicate five columns. Rai was a term channeled by Dave Worster. Well, Dave Worster channeled cosmic awareness from 1967 to 74. And he announced that Rai, an ancient something, caused the first separateness. And he would tell the story that being was on the plane of essence. Not too many problems there. But then, so each rhythm of that plane of essence, and these could come from traditional occult stuff like the theosophical ideas. So the plane of essence was, say, red. Then it would ripple and blue would take over from the red. And it might go to green, and the blue would disappear. But either from red to blue or blue to green, just at some stage, there'd be a little bit of the red that would not disappear as it moved into a blue, you know, I might say a medium, a coloration. The blue coloration fails to take over completely from the red. So a judging action happens, which he would say is a green would show up. And the green would smash the red holdout. And the plane of essence, the majority of it had become blue, it would object to green being uptight about red holding. The blue gang was going to wait for the red, but green was impatient and smashed the red. So the blue gang, the blue being, chased green. And green spiraled off and went down into densities of matter and ended up in what we would call, it was creating each density as it was going. So it gets to a point where it lodges itself in a density which we know as this physical plane. And sort of like a bunker. He's kind of like a Dr. No in a James Bond movie, you know. He's a renegade. Takes off, and he has a secure bunker in a very dense material plane. And
when you say he, are you talking about Green? Or are you talking about Bob? Or who's the he?
It's not a maybe a human. It's Rai. Oh, okay.
Oh, okay, so, all right.
Yeah, I forgot to say the green spot that smashed the red and then took off, and the blue chased it, and then it ends up green ends up lodged in a physical dimension. It is made maybe dense enough to protect itself, to be isolated. That's a separation from the general milieu of red shifting to blue to shifting to yellow or green or any other color. And that was called Rai. So it was the first principality, the first separateness, the first judge. Now, this is how Dave Wurster would describe it. And I met him in the late 60s, and he told me this story. So
a lot of this is very familiar from Gnostic,
yes,
speculation a couple thousand years ago.
That's right. So the blue gang, blue milieu, decided to create a female. So Rai seems to be a male principle. So a female principle was created, Isis, and it went down to the physical dimension and made it an agreement with Rai to continue Rai's creation, his isolated dimension, by creating children. So the human species of evolving or growing begins. Now the plan was at some point Isis would attract Rai to the plane of essence. And this turned out to happen in the cosmic awareness cult or group out in Seattle. Happened in on January 22nd, 1967. January 22nd, 1967, on one of the Hawaiian Islands. The first channel for cosmic awareness was a guy named Ralph Dubey, who had a very interesting history in the 50s. And he started channeling cosmic awareness in 62, maybe as a way to get out of his cancer that he was growing. And by 66, he was sort of favoring the rich people in the cult, and in the supposed answers that cosmic awareness was giving to the group. Now, Dave Wurster noticed this. He was a member of the group, so he quit. He didn't like that. And Ralph, he actually did a Rai kind of thing. He took off with the rich members of the cult to Hawaii, and he hung out there for about a year. But he ended up having these massive heart attacks on January 21st, 1967. And the mythology that came out of that was Ralph was channeling, no, was acting out, miming the physical body and its principle of separateness and it's in returning, or it's miming the return to the plane of essence, no more separateness. So the world had changed on January 22nd, 67. And so the group that was still back in Seattle, they started to miss the channelings of cosmic awareness, so they got Dave Worster to do it. So he became the second channel. So I never met Ralph Doobie, but I did get to know Dave Worster. So the mythology was that Rai split, when Rai was still separate, split up into four forces. Rai is spelled R-H-Y-E-E, but it broke up into Eloi II Lofty and Rai, R-A-I, like Italian TV. So Rai becomes Rai, R-A-I, Eloi II and Lofty. So to show some kind of beginning metaphysical situation, I started the chart with those four forces and then added myself. So if you notice, underneath Rai, Eloi, Tu, Lofty, Bob, you first thing you have horizontally are colors. So there's the implying the story that Dave Worster tells. But then
And what's the? Let me just ask what is the attraction to you, to your thinking, to your shuffling the deck all the time? What's the attraction to you of this kind of origin story, number one, and number two, the channeling that's going with it?
Well, Dave Worster was the first psychic channel I met, and I found him to be very intelligent, and he had read McLuhan. That was a big marker for me. If so, this is back in the late 60s. McLuhan was sort of known, but you know, not by many people. And when I brought up McLuhan, he said, yes, he had read him. And that, for me, made the person interesting. So even though he did the channeling, which was pretty interesting in itself, I liked what it said. Or it was a new, it had a new kind of metaphysics, kind of rejected all the previous metaphysics, and even offered development classes, which were designed to undo the Order of the Golden Dawn, which Yeats was a member of, and Aleister Crowley, more famously a member of, you know, 19th century spin-off from Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society. But for some reason, Cosmic Awareness said the principality, the replay of Rai that they were trying to set up or to continue the principle of Rai had to be undone. So that was pretty revolutionary to me. You know, they weren't trying to repeat an occult tradition. They wanted to move it into what they called the new. Awareness said, okay, we've got a new age coming, and the emphasis is on new. Very new, different from what you think new is, new, you know? So Worster had a really interesting mind. He had been a draftsman for NASA, so he worked on some of the early rockets or space vehicles. He didn't know which one he was working on, but he did that. He also had an affair. He was gay, and he had an affair with Tennessee Williams, down in New Orleans, and actually in the gay community in New Orleans in the early, middle 50s, he met Clay Shaw, a really prime suspect in the JFK murder. Do you know that name?
Yes, I do.
So Dave Worster, he was the first person I met who would watch the news, and you know, every few months he'd noticed that something he'd been doing with his gay partner, Vern Christensen, would show up in the media. So he was the first person I ever met who saw himself reflected out there in the news. Not in a silly way, like they would coin, I think they came up with some word like psychotherapy in the late 50s, and then it started to be talked about out in the news world. Now, what was special about Dave Worster is he's born in 1928, same year as Don Thiel. A lot of interesting people were born in 1928, Gerard Stern, Andy Warhol. Warhol is argues between 26 and 28. Baudrillard was born in 1929. The end of the 20s produced a lot of interesting characters. And Worster, he met Bob Carr, who was a young medium in Seattle. And then they got in touch with Captain Al Hubbard, who was the Tim Leary of the 50s. He was the only guy allowed, and he had CIA connections, British intelligence connections, mystery character. He was the only guy allowed to have access to Sandoz LSD and give it to people in North America. So he was interested in what would happen if you got sensitive, psychic, or intelligent people on LSD, not people that were ill, which was the ostensible reason you used it for alcoholism or schizophrenia and different things in Saskatchewan. You know about, you know that story, the clinic in Saskatchewan, Humphrey Osmond?
Vaguely. You know, I'm from Saskatchewan, and I remember this from years ago, but it's kind of gone out of my consciousness since then.
Right. Okay. So, just a minute. I had to sneeze. So Humphrey Osmond was part of this Captain Al Hubbard network. Another guy, I forget his name right now, he created orthomolecular medicine later, which Carol's on the board of. Another sneeze. So from 57 to 60, Captain Al Hubbard lived up in New Westminster, I think, British Columbia, in that area. And he would come down regularly and give Dave Worster's group LSD. And he would monitor what they did on these sessions. So they were taking it intelligently. And over 3 years, they did about 150 trips. And so Al Hubbard sort of made an inventory of what was going on with these people, men and women. And the Dalai Lama's brother came across this group and was part of it for a short while in 59 or so. So they had this intense experiment, and they worked out the what's called setting and the protocols to make the experience, you know, more harmonious. And Tim Leary and those guys, 5-7 years, worked out the idea of settings, not knowing about Worster and them. But so that was an example of Worster doing something, and then it shows up and becomes a big phenomenon. Now, so this happened regularly with him, it seemed to me. So I kept that in mind, and I took the development courses. There were 12 sessions. At the 10th session, Carol and I, who were we weren't married at that point. This is in 69. We decided, well, we don't want to be brought into a cult, so we dropped out at session 10 and didn't do 11 and 12. And Dave and them, a little irritated, but it was no big deal. We remained friends, and then we all traveled down to Los Angeles in March 1970, and that's where I went to a Krishnamurti lecture. You ever heard of him? Did you do a Krishnamurti?
Sure, of course. Yeah, of course.
Right, so I went to a lecture by him, and he was talked a lot seriously by Cosmic Awareness, so it was sort of, you know, part of the scene, Cosmic Awareness scene, to experience Krishnamurti. And you'll notice...
Let me just interrupt for half a sec. Weren't you more or less based in Nova Scotia around this time?
Yes.
How are you going from one side of the continent to the other?
Well, when Carol and I hooked up in Dartmouth, Halifax area in the late 50s, we traveled all the time, often hitchhiking. It was a bit out of the way, Dartmouth and Halifax, and we'd come from Paris, so we needed a little more stimulation. So we would visit all kinds of different organizations or things that we found out about. So we visited Dave Wurster when we found out about him in 1969 in September. So, and he greeted us, and so we stayed there for 8 months in Seattle and got involved and took the courses and met all these interesting people in Seattle. They used to say that Seattle was a pretty cool city because it had the largest number of atheists of any city in the United States. And these beatniks, they liked it. They were beatnik guys. Dave Wurster in 1960, after he did the three-year LSD situation, he went down to San Francisco with Ralph Dubey and Vern, and they ended up being close friends of Alan Watts, who later, you know, visited McLuhan. You know who he is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Anton LaVey, he was a younger guy, the guy who started the Church of Satan a few years later. He was a roommate of Wurster. So they met these interesting characters in San Francisco for a few years. Then they moved back up to Seattle in 62. And Dave left the draftsman world and became a jewel dealer, I think it is. No, rare coins, maybe, dealer. So they were always moving around and maybe being part of the homosexual underground culture, but they were into metaphysics and stuff. And L. Ron Hubbard came to the institute they called the Center of Integration, which went on from 57 to 60. That's where they had the LSD. He came and read some poetry with his clothes off. So it was the beginning of the New Age circuit that, you know, expanded to Esalen at Big Sur in California. So Dave met and interacted with all kinds of people. And I had met a lot of different people, but not that network. So I met a lot of them through Dave. And I enjoyed always being able to discuss McLuhan with him, because McLuhan was, to me, the bigger of them all. You know what I mean? He just seemed more important. So I always brought up McLuhan with people to see what they said, or introduced McLuhan to them. So he had an interesting background. He knew a lot of interesting people, so he was my kind of person. I was not homosexual, so I didn't have any sex with him or anything, but that didn't matter. He was basically lived in his mind, it seemed, plus the channeling. So as an obscure background to myself, I put these quizzical terms in, Rai Eloi Tu Lofty. And then so I put the colors on the first horizontal row. Then I put basic physics, proton, electron, neutron. Then I did cosmic, cosmos stuff, red giant, white dwarf, quasar, pulsar. Then I took five types of TV from Arthur Croker: sacrificial TV, crash TV, disciplinary TV, surveillance, and experimental TV. Then from William Irwin Thompson, I took elementals, goblins, fairies, humans, and angels. From regular science, but in William Irwin Thompson's books, prokaryotic cells, anaerobic bacteria, cyanobacteria, eukaryotic cells. You see, I'm going across the lines there, right?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And then from regular sort of more cosmos stuff, electromagnetism, gluon, boson, graviton, wormhole slash X particle, and then music, bass guitar, drummer, organ, vocals, and then Platonic geometry, the Platonic solids, circle, hyperbola, ellipse, parabola, cone slash torus, and then from McLuhan, front spin, back spin, retrieval, chiasmus, melody. So that was an odd way to write the tetrad, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those were, I wanted to have as much of the universe, so to speak, or of human creativity in that area. But then you have, and that's sort of like first nature. You know what I mean? It's like stuff we didn't make, even though I do have musical instruments in there. But I'm looking at what the book of nature, you could say, right? And I'm looking at modern terms. But a little strange, too, I had these five colors as part of the initial.
The impetus seems to be that in origin there is structure.
Yeah.
And the structure that you're working with here is a fivefold structure that at least off the top of my head, especially from the line that goes molecule, proton, electron, neutron, atom, it seems that there's three primary components and then two subsidiary components. So it looks like the idea is that there's a structure is basic, triadic structure is basic, and then some sort of pentic development from the triadic structure is sort of the next in line.
Right. Did you say pentic?
Yeah.
Yeah, P-E-N-T-I-C. So if you look down now, just you scan down the chart, you see Holopathic Radio in the left title position of the first quadrant, Holopathic Radio / Satellite, Holopathic Television / Satellite, Holopathic Computer / Satellite, Holopathic Satellite Squared, and then Anthropomorphic Physical. There's five parts, five areas, but I call them quadrants. So I would mix up the four and the five, because I had learned that in alchemy, the West favored four and Asia favored five. So I kept it blurred. Do you see what I'm saying? I kept it not determined, not exact. It's four, it's five parts, but I call them quadrants. Well, that's because the fifth level, anthropomorphic physical, the Dobbs quadrant, subsumed the first four. So there's still four, but something's being organized from the fifth level. So you could say that is a quadrant, or whatever the fifth word would be, thank you quadrant, thank you rent. Pentarant. Anyways, it merged and it didn't. So it had a tactile relationship to the first four. And so that is why in the bottom right corner, the ratios of the charts is what's going on here. So if you get involved with the content of the Tino chart, you might forget that it came out of the formula chart. So I wanted to remind one of the interplay between the charts. And so because Rumpelstiltskin is a mythic character or folk character, what was the main point about him? That if you didn't know his name, he was free to rule a roost or cause chaos or do all kinds of things. Once you named him, knew his name, you controlled him. And I remember McLuhan once saying, you know, you control things by naming them. He said something like that. Naming helps you to control it. So I'm presenting a picture of the Android meme, and it's not understood. Nobody knows how to name it correctly. So it's a Rumpelstiltskin atmosphere, Rumpelstiltskin aspect or replay or archetype. And my chart is showing you how to name the Android meme. But it's not just nominalism. You name the name. You've got to understand its structure. And knowing that is part of your naming of it. So that's why that is the most important action down in the right-hand corner. And note, it covers the range of the Android meme, 1960 to 1990. It was the whole chart. So
it's the it's the idea of poetry that Eliot was developing in the teens and 20s, and that Richards and Empson and McLuhan were trying to figure out how it worked in the 30s and 40s. And you could say that what the Cambridge English School was trying to do was figure out the name for this poetry, but that the name was not something singular, it was not a label, it was inherently structural and inherently riven.
Would you say riven, R-I-V-E-N?
Riven, riven as in gapped.
Yeah, gaps, yes. No, exactly. And you know, you can see the influence of McLuhan here in my thinking about it. So, what was I going to say about the naming process? This is a flat plane, flat piece of paper. I would hand it out as a piece of paper. And there's a video of me explaining it to my buddies in L.A. And looking at the long piece of paper and going through its structure. But you were to realize this is so far off from what we're actually dealing with. You simplify it to a page, it's ridiculous. So you had to recognize the bias in the presentation. But it was showing a process that we're living in, and McLuhan liked to point out that the first Adam just named the animals, but the second Adam, after being booted out of the whatever that was, paradise, the Garden of Eden, then the second Adam had the power to create their own establishment, and I would call that technology and second nature. McLuhan and Barry Nevitt used to talk about first nature and second nature. So we're looking at second nature here and how it's evolved, and also including the naming aspect of the first Adam. I mean, the second Adam created by naming, created environments. So, and that would include gesture. So I'm presenting, and this is where your chemistry point is relevant. I was saying that science and its understanding of matter was really limited because I looked at these media environments as new aspects of matter. So it was way more complex how to do science or to do alchemy that nobody had really spelled out other than McLuhan started it. Because in his book, Understanding Media, you got... He's like Aristotle. He classifies the elements of the new situation. It's a classificatory. And I thought that had to be updated. So I will explain the structure that we're up against. So the first five at the top, I'm including the purpose is to show the physics, the cosmos, and the subatomic, but it's more complicated than traditional knowledge up to that point. So it's very ambitious what I was trying to do. You get that?
I do. You know, I don't know that it was an innovation. I think this... people have tried to figure out this sort of stuff sort of forever. You may have arrived at stuff that is truly new at some point, but I see this as ways that people have tried to figure out the relationship between what was in the beginning and what is now forever.
Yeah. But I brought in, one wouldn't even recognize it, that was what I was doing if I didn't tell them. All right?
Uh-huh.
Because the words are so, what's homeopathic radio satellite? What's that? Is that a factor in matter? You know, so it was obscure. Okay.
But, let me just go back to the poetry point for a minute. When Eliot was writing Wasteland, let's say, in the early 20s, and thinking about what was going on in poetry, his whole effort could be called naming.
Yeah.
Right? He could be, the whole of the Wasteland could be seen as a kind of naming. And the Wasteland, like your chart, brings in all sorts of stuff from long ago and most recent, and from popular culture and high culture and science, all this sort of stuff, right? So there's an effort of naming going on that regards naming as something very complex and that has to range over everything that is, in a way.
Yep.
And then when Richards, who was a close friend of Eliot, is trying to say what's going on with his poetry, his criticism, the new criticism, could be taken to be a just another kind of naming. There's naming at different levels, you could say, and it's not clear how those levels interrelate, but they are different kinds of processes of naming that are trying to solve the riddle.
Yeah,
the Rumpelstiltskin riddle.
Right, exactly. So I'm going to have LaRouche stuff, LaRouche knowledge, or what he wrote in this. I'm going to have McLuhan knowledge. I'm going to have William Irwin Thompson and Arthur Coker and my own eccentric knowledge, some of it coming from cosmic awareness. And then the second medium, Michael Blake Reed, channeled the Evergreens. And they were pretty fantastic. So I'm bringing that aspect, but not no one else that we know of generally. Well, what do we say? I mean, Yeats certainly engaged the mediumistic. But nobody told people they were doing it. I would talk about it on the radio. I would have Dave Worster on in the 80s in Toronto and interview him, talk about this stuff. And then I would have the Michael Blake Reed's channelings. When Marsh McLuhan, you know, passed on, after a few years, I started having conversations with him, and I would play them on the radio. So that was a new way of presenting an esoteric activity. You know what I mean? I wasn't worried about my reputation or anything. I wasn't in academia. But I wanted to stretch people's ideas of sources of information. Because the Evergreens were, anybody listened to them and said, wow, that's intelligent. Whatever that is, it's very intelligent. And they could do science in detail better than any other New Age mediums. So they were used by the CIA and the State Department. There's a whole bunch of background story about them. So we'll call that odd knowledge. Like you take the trivium and the quadrivium, you could fit LaRouche's dialectics, McLuhan's rhetoric, Thompson's grammar, Croker's Marxist. But anyways, you could put the seven arts in there. But then I would add the occult. And, you know, McLuhan points out that grammar was alchemical, which could be considered occult, but actually talking to spirits and that stuff was the eighth division that I added to the seven arts. And then I also added the ninth art, which is people often, if they're lucky, they meet somebody who's charismatic or something, and they have a very special relationship, and they get mentored by that person in some way. So I added that as another part of education. Added that to the trivium and quadrivium. And then you form a group, which I called a club. And so the tenth aspect of education was a society or group you formed. It didn't have to be a cult or anything. And so mine was called Club 22, because 22, when I did McLuhan's archives in November, December 1981, a year after he had died, I had to go through 60 boxes of clippings and articles and that. And Mrs. McLuhan and Mady Molinaro wanted to know what decades do these articles apply to, were they maybe positioned. And because I knew Marshall's work very well, I could figure out which decade these things belonged in. So
I'm like the archivist in Ottawa.
So, well, you have to hand it to Philip Marchand. He did the archives, and he got a book out of it. Boy, that was pretty smart. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
He made notes.
And a good book, in my opinion.
Yeah. A fun book, interesting book. Good introductory book. But what was I saying? So when I first got the 60 boxes, I was going through them. I got the box 22, and I found a folder that had my name on it. It said Bob Dobbs, McLuhan Archivist. Now, I never knew that I was that, you know, when Marshall was alive. So I opened it up, and what was there was a Xerox of the bibliography that made that little beige book. It was red first. The bibliography of McLuhan. Did you ever have a copy of that?
Yeah, I think so. The one that was done in Florida?
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. And what was his name? Bob Hidell or something? Bob Hildell. Anyways, you know, he's a good friend of McLuhan's, and he made a booklet. Well, in 75, 76, when they were organizing it, I was a friend of Mark Stewart's, McLuhan's secretary, and so she gave me the Xerox of the pages before they became a book. So I went around Toronto and all the libraries and that and found stuff and had my own little inventory. Then the book came out in 77, and or I got it from 75, but not till 77. So I had that. And in 78 or so, George Thompson asked me one day, can we see what you have? And I said, okay, I'll make a Xerox of the Xeroxings that I got from Mark Stewart of the whole, generally the whole book. And so I gave him a copy of my Xeroxing with all the things that I had checked off. So that was that. I gave him a copy. So then I, you know, a couple years later, 3 years later, I'm going through the box, and there's a file folder that they put my copy I gave them of the bibliography in a file folder and called me McLuhan Archivist. So from that point on, I called myself a McLuhan Archivist. I always pointed out it wasn't official. I didn't get paid. But I, with that bibliography, I was able to really, you know, build up my collection. And so I had the biggest archives until the library archives was formed in Ottawa in 84 or so. Why am I saying that?
I think you were getting to the number.
Oh, just the fact that I was McLuhan, how I became McLuhan Archivist. I was named that. And it was Box 22. That's the point. It was Box 22, and Ms. McLuhan drove me home, and I lived at 22 Kenwood, and I said, oh, 22 again. And then the next couple of days, I noticed 22 in my life. I'd always added up numbers. The first pattern I noticed when I was a kid was that any number multiplied by 9, the sum adds up to 9, right? So I think that started me looking at numbers. So I would notice my birth certificate added up to 9, my wedding date added up to 22. And so 22 riddled my life a lot. So I mentioned this to a Toronto poet named Ian Arlett. And that was that. We didn't talk about it anymore other than that one time. And I was probably telling him this story about how I was in Box 22. So 6 months later, he comes back, and because he's a poet, he always had a notebook and was writing down ideas and stuff for his poetry. He hands me his notebook, And it has newspaper clippings. It's bulging. Newspaper clippings and articles and notes and jottings by himself, riddled with 22 showing up everywhere. And he says, man, I started noticing these 22, and it became so numerous, it was driving me nuts. So you take this notebook. I don't want it. So he gave it to me. So I developed the 22 thing more and more. And so when I, around the time, just before I got on the radio, I'd met Nelson Thal and James Kidney, and Ian was part of this and a few others. We would talk about McLuhan and all these things, and I was listening to May Brussel recordings and Lynn LaRouche stuff and Dr. Beter. So that whole activity, the salon, we called Club 22. So that's where...
And this is early 80s.
Right? Yep. It started in 82. Well, the box was discovered in late 81. So then sometime halfway through 82, Ian gives me his notebook. And then I noticed it, and then in 83, I met Nelson Thal and James Kidney, who was a Toronto actor, and he was playing, he did a play on Lee Harvey Oswald with Amanda Plummer. Maybe she was Christopher Plummer's daughter. And he just passed away the other day, right? Christopher Plummer?
Right. Famous. And he did have a daughter that was an actress, I know that.
Yeah. And so it was about a relationship between Lee and Marina, and I had the Torbett document, which was the best x-ray of the Kennedy assassination at that time that May Brussel always recommended. She lived out in Carmel, California. And James was a patient of Carolyn and told her about the Kennedy play she was doing, and she said, oh, you got to meet my husband. So her office was on the first floor of 22 Kenwood, so he came upstairs and we met, and we became friends over him reading the Torbett document and getting a more conspiratorial view of the Lee Harvey Oswald character. So that helped him. But he had not heard of McLuhan, and I played him some recordings of McLuhan, and he said, wow, that's the best voice I've ever heard as an actor or a public speaker. So he became, as an actor, you know, developing his voice in that, he was very intrigued by McLuhan on the voice level. So, and then I met Nelson around that time, and we just took off really talking about McLuhan. And then I end up on the radio, and they came on the radio with me for a special we did. So
at that time, did you know that about Joyce and 22?
I knew about Robert Ed Tom Wilson and 23, but 22, I noticed 22 would show up in his writings, but also October 8th, 04, I think he was 22 when he left Dublin. And 19,
maybe, but he was born on 22.
No, yes, February 2nd, my birthday. Yes,
so
I knew that part of 22. Yes.
Yeah.
And born in 1882, and then he had the copy of Ulysses was given to him on his birthday, February 2nd, 1922, and also that was Eliot called it the Annus Mirabilis, the miraculous year. You know, so much happened in that year, beginning with the finding of the Tutankhamun Egyptian treasures or mummy and all that stuff. That had an influence on a lot of people, including Eliot and Lewis and Joyce and probably Yeats and Pound. So, yes, I knew 22 was all around Joyce, but I didn't know if he noticed it. Do you know anything about that? Did he talk about 22?
Not that I know of, but...
Right.
It would be very strange if in Finnegan's Wake it doesn't occur somewhere.
Yeah, there is a 22 here and there in Finnegan's Wake. But some people say, well, that's the Kabbalah. You know what I mean? And McLuhan said you need to know the Kabbalah to get around in the Wake, the signatures of the Kabbalah. So Joyce certainly knew the occult part of 22. But the synchronicity part, did he see that? I don't know. I'm explaining the 22.
Now, you were talking about the structure of the tiny note chart, and you got over to 22 somehow. I'm not quite sure.
Right.
22 is in the chart, but you weren't at that point.
I was explaining how I added to the Trivium and how I got Club 22.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so where Club 22 came from. So back to the chart. I wrote an essay called Up the Orphic Ante in 1995 and part two, Silencing the Virtually Solar Theater. So you had the global theater, and then I added the solar theater. I had an insight in 1990-91 after Pons and Fleischmann had announced the cold fusion technology they had discovered, invented out in Utah. Did you ever hear about them?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So they became a cause célèbre, and a lot of people were trying to get them funding, and they got funding, but they also became exiled from the physics community or the chemistry community that they were in. And so I followed that closely, and I started thinking about how cold fusion was frictionless, as they presented it, was frictionless energy. And I decided that the satellite merged first and second nature. You could, McLuhan took the idea from Bucky Fuller that the satellite was an extension of our terrestrial environment. You know, you could go out there into a, you know, hostile space and remain alive by this little encapsulated Earth environment that you took with you. So I was thinking about cold fusion was frictionless and the merging of first and second nature represented by the satellite create this idea in me that we were merging into a new situation, and the proscenium arch that McLuhan said the global theater caused by the satellite ring around the planet, beginning with Sputnik. What is that echo? Do you know what that is? You hear that?
It's no, slow. I can't hear it.
Okay, it's just a little. Maybe it's because of the other phone I have. Anyways, so I decided that the global theater, with the satellites creating a proscenium arch and the theater, that's McLuhan's idea, in effect made people live in a hologram. The world was a hologram, or an environment that the hologram would show up as a technology, but the effects of it were already here. And so as we moved into the digital area, the hologram created by satellites and the communication matrix that it created would get tinier and tinier. It would, the hologram would go through the homeopathic process and get and shrink. So that process of shrinking was part of how I understood mirror. Remember I explained the mirror device that Carol was using?
Yeah.
I remember mirror, this technology is what I'm trying to figure. Okay, this is a new effect on matter, the combination of the four parts. So there's something new about matter that it evokes. And so I extrapolated into a satellite effect. Remember, the homeopathic effect potentizes herbs. But I'm saying that the global hologram is potentized, is made homeopathic, but it's a hologram. So I put the two words together and came up with homeopathic. So the chart is showing what happened to our environment after McLuhan's final extension, the satellite, which was an extension of the planet, right? So what were we extending after that? After that was the digital extension of machines, by machines, not our faculties, unless you said there was some digital aspect in our central nervous system or something. But generally, the extensions of the digital era people didn't understand them. They could see that a book was an extension of the eye, but what was being extended with the increasing virtual environments we were living in? So I renamed them holeopathic, that process. So it would use as its content the analog media. So you would have a holeopathic process done on the radio effect, then the TV effect, or the TV qualities, and then the computer qualities would be holeopathized. And then the process itself would be squared. And that's when you'd get the Android meme technology coming alive and doing strange things to us and going inside us. So that's the divisions, okay? So on the left, you've got holeopathic radio satellite. It's always slash satellite because that in the hologram's coming out of the satellite effect, the satellite environment. So you have the global theater. It's doing something to radio. It's doing something to television and computer and then squaring itself and becoming a new species. And all the time, humans are trying to figure out if there's anything human left. So they would project human qualities into it, and so I call that the anthropomorphic physical. Now, over on the right, far right column was the timings and dates of the phases and also ratios of the radio era and then the TV era. They had different ratios, different, McClure would say, different senses extended. But now it's ratios of sensory qualities that are being homeopathized. So you see how it's going a bit beyond McLuhan? We weren't extending senses. We were extending sensory ratios that were going into a strange mystery landscape that mirror this technology represented for me. And the whole process... go ahead.
Well, as you go through this stuff, I see some tensions between what's literal and what's not literal, and what is put forward in an experimental sense, and what's taken as a conclusion. And I see both of those as problematic in themselves, but also problematic when the time consideration is introduced.
Yeah.
Right? So maybe you could talk a little bit about how you regard those tensions in regards to your chart.
Yes. So there's a couple of McLuhan points. History ends in 1945. The telegraph, quoting Teilhard de Chardin, that McLuhan quoted, is a biological event. So these different dramatic aspects of the Marconi galaxy coming in to the Gutenberg galaxy and the Gutenberg galaxy's products. So I'm going to have what we call analog media going through phases, with the ground being the digital technology. So I'm saying that digital technology is an invisible environment from 1960 to 1990. You can read a history of MIT and the early scientists and what they were making in the late 50s and early 60s, right? They began to make the digital world. And
cybernetics.
Yes, and a key point was in 1969, first week of September 69, when they hooked up the first two computers in UCLA and... maybe Utah.
Berkeley, I think.
Beg your pardon?
I think it was Berkeley.
Yeah, might have been Berkeley. And then a month later, they added another one. That might have been in Utah. And then another one in November. And then they eventually, I think they got to MIT in December. So that began the creating of the spider's web, of the Matrix and all these popular images we have of something we're being enfolded in. That's partly why I used the Rai point, because Cosmic Awareness said that after Ralph Doobie died on January 22nd, 67, Rai had returned to the plane of essence, but there were still the cobwebs of Rai. So later, when string theory came up, I decided that the strings were almost holding on of scientific concept with McLuhan in mind, that we were living pure percept and concept couldn't keep up with it. So the scientists were trying to keep up, and so they developed string theory, which wasn't your normal science based on laboratory experiments. It was just a speculation of musical strings kind of thing. So I said, okay, there in the quantum physics, they were taking Newton's visual space and organizing that and then making some changes to it with the quantum revolution in the 20s. But they had to drop the visual background completely by our time, say the 90s, and so they went to acoustic. They had to use the acoustic vibrations as part of matter or the structural elements of matter. So I thought that was the cobwebs of Rai. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. String theory. And I make that
metaphor.
Yeah, so
you're saying that strings can be taken as musical strings, therefore acoustic, and that acoustic can then be used as a structural representation of anything rather
nature.
Than the visual.
Right.
And furthermore, you're saying that just like string theory works through multiple dimensions, you're saying that there's a hologram effect that can be understood working through multiple dimensions as well.
Right, and this enters into the popular consciousness. There's all kinds of books about the world as a hologram, and people started saying it was a quantum society, we're all a part of a hologram. So that became part of the popular imagery in the 80s, 90s. Now, what I was thinking as a new scientist, I said the next ground will be tactility. So, you know, you had visual space, acoustic space, and tactile. So I'm trying to show the tactile qualities of this new matter. I mean, there is tactility in our brains or in our sensory nervous system, but the extension of it is affecting matter, and that's where I was laying out a new scientific theory, another ambitious thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But if they could make up stuff in the string theory world, then I could enter the game and make stuff up. And, of course, always having McLuhan's new nature and the new science in mind. You know what I mean? Just trying to develop that. So the strings, the resonances were holopathic radio satellite, holopathic television satellite, holopathic computer, holopathic satellite squared, all within me as an anthropomorphic phenomenon trying to see if there's anything anthropomorphic in our world.
Yeah.
Still carrying on that enterprise. So that's mm-hmm. how the five quadrants reflect the five columns at the top. So that orange is LaRouche, and I'll explain how I get LaRouche. Eloy is McLuhan. T-U is Thompson, Lofty is Croker, and Bob is anthropomorphic physical. So why do, you know, I've got a holopathic radio satellite, and now I'm going to use all kinds of phenomena that make up matter in our new merger of first and second nature, but I also have to include the cyborg aspect, the post-human, or the human merging with the machine. And McLuhan says in 1950 we have total fusion, and it's going to get more and more intense. So I'm developing the fusion aspect. So with LaRouche, it is his intellectual product that becomes part of the era of the holopathic radio satellite. But he's replaying Ezra Pound. So each quadrant is actually, in the analog phase, the major people are Ezra Pound, Wyndham Lewis, T.S. Eliot, William Yeats, and William Butler Yeats, and James Joyce. And since the Android meme is a replay of analog human life, what'd you say?
I didn't say anything.
Oh, just heard a sound. So the Android meme's a replay of the developments up to 1945. Then LaRouche is just a replay of Ezra Pound. And if you read Cantos, it's incredible. All the historical elements and personalities that Ezra Pound highlights around the theme that usury is bad, and he looks for civilizations that, or cultures that weren't built on usury to get better art, better beauty, they're the exact same elements. Historical figures that LaRouche uses. So I was reading LaRouche at the same time I was reading Cantos in the 80s, and I said, wow, he's talking about the battle with the first presidents, the Hamiltonian versus the Jeffersonian. Pound has that going on in the Cantos, and LaRouche redoes it, not aware of Pound at all. And then they go back to the Italian Renaissance and ancient Greece, all these periods of so-called, you know, renaissances that Ezra Pound features in the Cantos are featured in LaRouche. So I thought that was an interesting point. Most people didn't like LaRouche. They didn't want to understand him. They thought he was a fascist or something silly. They didn't respect his mind, but so they weren't thinking about him, but I was the first one to see that Pound was a LaRouche was a replay of Pound. You see what I'm saying? So Pound, okay, what's this here? A second. Pound, he was born in 1922 and he just died a year or two ago, but he's a 1922 person. And as a...
No, he wasn't born in... Maybe LaRouche was born in...
Oh, sorry, yeah. No, Lynn LaRouche, born in 1922. Yeah. And Mae Brussels was born in 1922, and she's the other person in the LaRouche or radio quadrant. I wanted to put a woman in there somewhere, so I picked Mae Brussels. So LaRouche is dealing with the McCarthy era, and people think that he was a McCarthy kind of figure in American politics. He was always running for president. So he is 1947 to 57, that sensibility, the radio era. And it crystallizes in 1960, but he's actually a replay of 1840 to 1900, the world that influenced Pound. So you have the radio satellite, the effects preceding causes, so radio technology is intuited in the science of the 19th century, 1840 to 1900. LaRouche is the human cyborg of that era, so he begins to surface in 1960, and he represents 47 to 57, which is a crystallization of the McCarthy era, when the McCarthy people went into panic mode under maybe TV conditions and replayed the politics of the 19th century and the, you could say, the anti-communism, the anti-Semitism, and all those factors that were prominent in the 19th century. So you see what I'm laying out here?
Well, I mean, I see in some senses, but I don't see in the most important sense, and that is that I understand the connections, which are often tactile connections that you're talking about, but I don't see the point. I don't see what it is that you're trying to get at through this intellectual effort to penetrate things You look back and you see all of this work, which I'm sure you regard as being updated and renewed later on, what is it that you're trying to do through this process?
Okay, in the Dobbs chart, remember I was showing the interactions and evolutions and retrievals and flip points of technologies.
Sure.
This is more the realm of culture and ideas. And they as products of their different media grounds.
Right, I understand all that, but let me put it another way. I mean, you could understand what you just said as you doing history.
Yeah.
It's Bob doing history in a new way.
Yeah.
Right? But I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think history is, what you want to do. I think you want to do something else, but I don't know what that something else is.
Oh, I'm trying to show how MIR came about and the contributions by people and media and eras going back to 1840 to the miracle of MIR. So I'm explaining how technologies feed on each other, and there are different aspects of each area in psychology and in sociology and in art and music. I wanted to show the complex of each phase and how their qualities pointed to a great integration and a new kind of science that represented MIR. Now, mm-hmm. It turned out MIR was puny compared to what I was really pointing at, and I didn't know, because when ION showed up in 2009, that was what I unconsciously was anticipating. And so at the very bottom, we have the statement, waiting, the bar is stuck.
Waiting for organic bodies.
Yes. This whole process, 150 years, is waiting for something to happen with our bodies. The spinning clothing crystals have danced the hex advertisement. So each quadrant is a spinning crystal. It's a medium, and I'm using McLuhan's clothing metaphor. And they're interacting, dancing and juggling. And the Android meme, like the satellite, anticipated cold fusion. But the Android meme and its fusion and tactility is anticipating the products and the phenomenon of ION. But I did not know that in 1995. MIR was the
right.
Best thing I had for a model.
Right. So this might be portrait of an artist as a young man, right? Setting out here without knowing it entirely, you're setting out the education of Bob Dobbs to this period here.
Right, but I would say I was a figure for the education of humans and humanity, what was happening to us. I certainly didn't.
Right.
I thought that I was lucky in finding the thinkers and art forms that indicated what was happening. Because Joyce, McLuhan, all of them, all these names, those people, they all thought they were pointing to a new something that was being created, a new spirit, a new matter. And so in that tradition, I thought I was seeing further than they had seen. So I was updating the cantos or Finney's Wake mm-hmm. or McLuhan's Understanding Media or Laws of Media, Thompson's books, Krishnamurti, Mae Brussel, Dr. Beter, and what I thought Garrett Dean was pointing to. That was my personal mentor, Garrett Dean. So my point is to show how as a poet in tune with the present, I, like McLuhan said, he said he was very lucky in who he met. I felt lucky in who I met, including people like Dave Worster, that led me to a phenomenon that both Carol and I were creating. She in medicine, me in some other level. So now we have way better technologies than MIR that we're getting ready to present the work to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, recently meeting with the Department of Homeland Security that is investigating us. And there's a lot of puzzling about what we've made and how we did it. So I didn't know it at the time, but my chart, to me, as I learned more and more from ION and what we made, my chart anticipated this. And so I have a deeper explanation of the chart now than I did in 95. So it did have a point,
sure.
but it was unfolding.
But let's just take one of the images that you used in your description just a few minutes ago. You said something like there was Bob Dobbs getting educated, but getting educated for humanity, something
right.
like that.
Well, reflecting, mirroring, reflecting xenochronously, that's a Zappa word, what was happening to humanity.
Right, right. But there's two ways of... here, 1 second, Bob.
Yeah.
Carmen?
Yeah.
The dog has no water here at all. There's two ways of hearing that, right? One could imagine Bob Dobbs as... the Colossus of Rhodes standing above humanity with the lantern and sort of bringing humanity to itself through the vastness of the colossal vision of this figure.
Yeah, did you say bringing humanity to itself? What was that word, humanity?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Or could imagine Bob Dobbs as somebody small and as limited and as mistake prone. In other words, as a very humanitarian figure, not because of his colossal size, but because of how typical he is and having a special significance only because he's trying to penetrate that typicality.
Yes.
And
I agree.
Maybe you're doing both. I'd be much more interested in the second than the first, but what do you say to those two?
I'm doing both. I'm a colossal figure and a little human. Carolyn's only 5'1", so I say Carolyn's the tallest midget in the world. And so I'm 5'9", so... I'm the smallest giant in the world. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I made the giant level, but I'm only 5'9". So I'm the smallest giant. Anyways, there's a lot of comedy and humor in the whole thing, but there's a lot of seriousness to it because of where we've gotten to. I mean, Carolyn is the best doctor in the planet. Her products... save everybody, and which is an amazing breakthrough. So, you know, a lot of people know about her, but not the whole world yet, but they will very shortly when the Black Death starts happening, and she is the only treatment for it. That's going to be significant. So there's a working out of what we've been doing for 50 years. So, 'cause I'm making this chart inspired by technology she discovered and got involved with. You see? So it's an intimate dialogue between me and Carolyn and what our personal careers and lives unfold and then bump into each other. So,
right. But you know what? But there's a difference between two kinds of story, right? One kind of story attempts through fumbling and error to reach some kind of vantage point, and then looks back on the Odyssey and explains it in terms of the vantage point that's been reached.
Yeah.
Another kind of story tells the Odyssey, and it's a series of adventures, you could say.
A what right? of adventures? Now, a series, did you say?
A series of
yes.
adventures, yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
And to me, it seems like the chart is more like a series of adventures that has the seeds of the vantage that you want to reach, but no more than the seeds.
Okay, well, you haven't been fully debriefed on the whole thing.
No, of course not. Of course not. But I'm trying to interview you. I'm trying to figure out what's going on in your being, right?
Well, good. Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate the interest. Okay, so I want to illustrate a little bit more of the structure or organization of the chart. Okay?
Yeah, sure.
How I bring everything in. So you got the title, Holopathic Radio Satellite. And then under Hadron, there's 11 items. It's always 11 items. And I have the subplot medium in the same position in each grouping of 11. So the newspaper...
When you talk about the 11, you're including the title.
No, newspaper, LaRouche, Ether, Paranoia, 22. Oh, yes, I am. There's 10 elements. Yes, I'm including the title.
Yeah, you need the 11 if you want to get to 22.
That's right. And I don't know if I did that consciously. I may have at some point, but this is a long time ago, when I made it. So the subplot medium is newspaper for LaRouche quadrant. Television is electric media, toys, entertainment media go with the television zone. And then the computer is the printed book. The satellite squared is the movie, and the anthropomorphic physical is the magazine / satellite. So magazine / satellite, that's where we've gotten with our internet. People uh-huh. get all kinds of media, old magazines as websites transmitted
right.
by so satellite.
Sort of identify your thinking in the chart, do you regard that as sort of an objective reality, or do you regard it as an interesting reflection on reality?
I'm trying to show what I did in the first chart, how things resonate with their quadrant and their media. So I'm still doing the figure ground thing. So these are figures inside the ratios on the far right of the holopathic satellite squared, say, 1945 to 60. So I'm saying that critical theory comes out of that. Johnny Rotten comes out of that environment. Panic comes out. Jim Brown in football. Gallery magazine. So when you look at each series of 10 points plus the title, they're all in the same position. So the subplot media, which is almost a retrieved effect. So movie is an effect of the holopathic satellite squared. Magazine is a reflection of the anthropomorphic physical phase. And they're all in the same position. They're at the top of the
right.
quadrant.
But there's a tension between the idea that we're dealing with different times.
Yeah.
And the idea that we're dealing with a hologram that has
it's made up of these different times.
That, well, but the hologram is reproduced in every tiny fragment of the universe, right?
Yes, yep.
Okay, so in that sense, there is no time.
Right, I agree.
Right.
So, because they're spinning clothing. This, once you make this into a video, they'd all be spinning around. There wouldn't be a flat sequence.
Correct, correct. So when you identify times, you must be saying, we've got this dance of particles, and we can beam different kinds of lasers, let's say, into this dance. And when we do that, we get different effects.
Yes.
Right? And
yeah.
So you could be seen as studying the cloud chambers of effects from the scattering that occurs from the hologram crystals, if you will.
Yeah.
And that you then label in various ways. You label the cloud chamber configurations.
Yes. Right?
But okay. So then, but that means that what you're talking about with 1840 to 1900 doesn't really have anything to do with chronology.
Right.
It has to do with a configuration, and that configuration. The naming of it is closer to poetry than it is to, let's say, quantum physics. And the what's the real force of what's going on is this effort to name that you mentioned with Rumpelstiltskin.
Yes,
it's a study of the cloud chamber of effects. That you hope can, how can I say that, can kind of ring a bell with people, with your fellow humans in such a way that they understand things differently and in a new light. That they have to do in our crazy situation.
Yes. So you know, people's normal entertainment diet, with all the different kind of shows they have, take Netflix with all the different movies of different eras, these eras are always being recycled. There's always a movie about the 19th century and a TV show about the 40s and something about the 80s. So these memes or zones or historical after images are circulating in the super angelic environment we're in, and it's the content. So I'm putting order to a certain era or timing by showing the sensory ratios of that period. So if you watch a movie about the McCarthy era, 1947 to 54, say,
right.
You could look at my chart and see echoes that'll show up in the movie, moods and themes. For example, what do I have? I have Time Magazine, which started in the 20s. I think it started in 23, almost 1922. So that old magazine, which was part of the Big Brother world before World War II, you know, blatant propaganda, but involving propaganda. People liked it. So you take Time Magazine and what it resonates for people. Now, those millennials and younger don't know any history. They don't know Time Magazine, and they don't know when it was. So on a, what do you call it, a pedagogical level, it's a way of explaining the media content that are inside of, but they don't have the historical book knowledge of what's being echoed. So this is a guide to what people are experiencing in their media entertainment.
But the you're fully aware that if somebody were trying to see what kind of movies were made, let's say, about 1950, not movies that were made around the year 1950, but movies that were made later concerning 1950.
Yes.
There isn't one kind, right? There's a huge variety, and what you're doing is you're specifying one way. You're saying, well, this is an interesting typology here for 1950 or for years around 1950 or something.
Yes.
But you're fully aware that that's not the only one. And it's something that may be interesting in terms of a kind of wider theory that you're putting forward. Or theory is the wrong word, but
I'd include that, not limited to that. That's the issue. You know, scientists are trying to come up with a theory of everything. They're not including all the factors. So I am trying to include all the factors and get beyond what you just said, be too specialized or too subjective about what I remember. I'm trying to show the broader myth, the pattern of that era and figures that, if you found out about who they are, would fit. I mean, definitely in that period, 47, 57, Mickey Mantle is a big image. And the movie in 1963, a little later, The Great Escape, shows some of the concerns of that period. So, okay, those interpretations are my subjectivity, but I think I'm trying to find things that are that I notice and are come out of my subjectivity, but that have some objectivity to them. I mean, everybody knew Mickey Mantle. You know, so it's a collective image.
Absolutely. But I guess what I guess one of the ways to put the questions that I've been trying to raise with you is what's your understanding of objectivity there? It's surely not a question of matching.
No.
Right? It's so what you're doing here is making, but as soon as the whole topic of making comes up, then the fact that you can situate Mickey Mantle as being, you know, the Triple Crown winner in 1957, which I think he was, it's interesting on a certain level, but that level is not objectivity.
No, no. I would say the objectivity I mean is iconography. So McLuhan said the only valid art of our time, content art, was the collage. So I'm trying to put the correct elements in the collage that represents the atmosphere of that era.
Right. Okay, good. So now I think we're getting somewhere from my point of view.
Okay.
So a collage, a person can put together a collage as a sort of an interesting artwork, a representation of their mind in action.
Yeah.
The pieces that are selected, the portions of the area of the artwork where the pieces of the collage are stuck, the size of the thing, all of these things can be a representation of mind, or they can be a representation of an era or of something that the artist is trying to express that it's not his or her own mind, it's something out there.
Yep, that's exactly it.
Okay, and so it's the latter that you're up to, right?
Yep, I'm trying to keep myself out of it as much as possible, but we have a kind of a collective consciousness in the 20th century. You know, a global Esperanto, all this common media and imagery that everybody shares or is aware of, and if they're aware of, they've experienced. The subjective responses, the user's content, is a millionfold in variety, in difference. So I'm trying to use cliche trigger points. Cliches. You know, like jazz. Cultural study.
But when you look at this now, do you think of it as something that is interesting as a representation that people can learn from, or do you see it as interesting because it's a way station along your education?
No, I think in dialectics, LaRouche is very important because I look at, when I describe at 95, I said, McLuhan dances on the toes of Catholic Thomism. LaRouche dances on the toes of technological liberalism. And this is with the McLuhan statement that all we can do now is dance on the other guy's toes. That's like angels on the head of a pin. That's what I've got in mind when I say dancing on the toes. Croker danced on the toes of Marxism. Thompson on the toes of Buddhism. I danced on the toes of Quadrophenia, which each one of them, these polymaths, were unconsciously expressing. So,
And that's a structure, right?
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, it's a structure.
Right. So I'm saying LaRouche, who is considered bonkers by mainstream science, but he did, was one of the first guys to jump on the bandwagon about cold fusion and came up with theories trying to explain it. He had to talk, you know, in a crazy way about something that nobody understood. So McLuhan's Thomism is way different from regular Thomism. Croker's Marxism is way different from normal Marxist scholars. Thompson's Buddhism is different. Now, the reason they're different, one of the factors is they're aware of McLuhan, and they know McLuhan is onto something that makes everything recycled differently, retrieved differently. So you actually be thinking about Buddhism like Thompson did, but come up with books that don't present the cliches of Buddhism. So you're dancing on the toes. That's the new kind of creativity by a human mind in this period of the 20th century coming into the 21st century. So I think...
It's probably inevitable at any time, right? It's the anxiety of influence.
Yeah.
As Harold Bloom said.
Yeah, now what did you say? It's what's happening every time? That was
all human life is a dancing on the toes,
yes,
of somebody or something.
But we
so that's always going on.
Yes, but the environment of being discarnate angels in the resonant node, that's a new area to dance on toes. And you do it by not literally dancing on toes. You write a review about some performance, or you make a video response to some art form that you've experienced, or some story, or news story. We're all communicating multimedia-wise with each other.
No, I understand that, but by bringing in this, I forget exactly the phrase you use, but this angelic understanding of what's going on in this chart. What you're doing, I think, is either you're bringing in something that that wasn't discussed before, or you're describing with new language. One of those two.
Yeah. Did you say re? What's re?
Re, the R-H-Y-E guy.
Oh, Rye.
Rye, all right.
Yeah, that's right. The constant. Humans create bubbles of separateness in their creativity. Like McLuhan said, that we can admire the carapace of Wyndham Lewis. That's an article in the Atlantic Monthly in December 69. He's saying we can admire the carapace of his art forms. The carapace is a shield, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so artists and bankers and everybody create shields, little modules around themselves. And the qualities of them are quite elaborate nowadays with the people's media clothing that they wear. So you could say that is the change in style, the change in manners. And McLuhan said that his own writings were a manipulative satire on the manners of the day. They weren't necessarily dealing with profound issues like his Catholic faith or something. You know, it was the distraction of the surface. But I think he also knew that these things were getting more and more embedded and weren't so superficial. What was fashion now is something else. Something penetrating people. So that leads to great confusion. So he says in Cliched Archetypes that Milton has Beelzebub confused mind with language. Wow, what do we confuse today? Our body organs, our images of ourselves, which you could call mind, with all these other bodies that we live in. Wow, what a massive amount. It's still the same tension, but the complexity of it is hard for people to see.
Absolutely, absolutely. But then if we ask, okay, what's the relationship between what you were just talking about and this chart? The question might be articulated as following. Very strange reality, very strange and dangerous reality that we're living requires new categories, new ways of thinking that have been wrenched out of traditional thinking in the West or in the East. That this kind of new thinking, this awareness of new dangers and of potential ways either around or through these dangers, this might be thought to be either represented in this chart in some way, or the chart could be regarded as a way station on the way to your thinking about those things today.
Yes.
And I think you'd probably say, oh, it's both.
Yep.
But,
and then I would say the Android meme it replays the both back to us. I see the Android meme as a mirror of us. A living, you know, organic mirror that is taking human foibles and human enthusiasms and creating a whole range of what I have in here, paranoia, schizophrenia in each quadrant, hysteria, panic, and ecstasy. See, so I'm showing that the Android meme replays this and is always trying to make humans engage the Android meme without noticing the Android meme. In other words, it becomes more and more real or involving. So that's what I'm showing here, the mirror.
Right, but isn't the most important thing about the mirror the difference between what appears in the mirror and what appears outside the mirror? Right? How can I say? The great danger is that people don't realize that what's in the mirror is eminently questionable. It's not a question of just what's in the mirror and what's outside of the mirror. It's that the whole reality in the mirror is fake. It needs to be seen through, but not back to some supposed original. Instead, the thinking that's required needs to understand that the mirror is there, and that and the sort of global manipulation is there, and the great question is how if at all we're going to extricate our minds in such a way as to be able finally to address the mirror and its manipulation.
Yeah, and that's what the two charts mean in the Rumpelstiltskin. The tiny node chart is the distracting multifarious contents of the mirror, and the formula chart is outside, is the framework of the mirror, or the reality that's more real than the mirror, or the process that the formula is showing is more important than the disparate cultural expressions of each era shown in on the tiny node chart. So yes, the tiny node chart is the mirror, and the formula chart is not the mirror.
Okay, and so in Aristotelian terms, the tiny node chart is the dynamic result of the causes, and the causes are what you're setting out in the formula chart.
Right, and then that the mirror has effects, and they merge, or they precede, or they follow. So yeah, that's I'm trying to show the interplay of the effects and the causes. Sometimes they're in quotes, sometimes they aren't. Sometimes they aren't, and the interplay of all that in the two charts, which is the Android meme does that to us, and it's the Rumpelstiltskin, this complex process.
Yeah. Right, and so what the charts, in their interaction and in their in their various interactions do is pose the question of the name.
Yes.
Right? And just as the wasteland can be considered a naming, but an unsuccessful naming because it fragments at the end.
Yeah.
So your naming that's going on in the interaction of these charts can be considered more of a question than an answer.
Yep.
But
to say we have the questions and they're more important than the answers is a cliche today. So I'm flipping that. Say, no, I've got the answers. We actually have some answers now. Which is what I say we have, what Carolyn has and what I've created with ION, with their...
Okay, but that's a different... But that's with the charts, we're talking 1995.
Yeah.
Right? And if the interactions between the charts were the answer or answers, plural, then you don't need to go further. Instead, what these things do is... pose a question in a non-cliché sense to you so that after 1995, you're moving on, right?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, the charts provide a summation of my experience up to that point. But, of course...
Springboard, maybe.
Yeah, springboard. And I found out from ION that... angels help make me make it. Now, angels, according to Ion, are not friends of humanity. They're competing with us to sit on the right-hand side of, quote, God. So it's pretty weird or sinister or what the angels were trying to do. So for some reason, they wanted to help make this chart. Maybe it would help confuse humans.
Uh-huh. We're getting back to Gnosticism again.
What?
Right? We're getting back to Gnostics in, 200 A.D.
Yes.
There was a lot of...
heresies.
This kind. Yeah, heresies, but people trying to kind of juggle the complexities of the universe.
Exactly. And so I'm showing five major jugglers. Well, four, but each quadrant has two names, so there's eight. I'm showing major jugglers who are extensions of major environments which are imploding and fragmenting in a tactile way more and more. And so the Android meme has become now something more strange, what I call the tech body, which is Ion's term, and my book is an updating of the chart to show how the Android meme has done something to itself, and now it's a tech body.
Okay, and when you say my book, you're talking about the Trump
book. Yeah, the pamphlet.
Okay, so the...
So that's the purpose of the book, jumping off from the charts. And that's why I appreciate you wanting to know what the charts are, because that's important for understanding the book.
Right, right. So then we can say that the one of the names that the chart is asking for is Trump.
Yes. Trump is the beginning, the end of the Android meme and the beginning of the tech body. And the tech body itself tells me that it put Trump in 2016.
Okay. But I don't understand the difference between the
Android meme and
Android
the tech body.
Android meme and the tech body, right.
I'm still naming that, working it out. You know, at the end of my book, I have an interview with the actual tech body. That interview happened through Ion, because the tech body, according to Ion, was made up of, I say was for a reason, was made up of 8/11 Ion, which included me and Carolyn, what I call Iondom, and 3/11 tech body. And Ion did not control 3/11. But now, 5 years, 6 years later, we are more and more lost in the black mirror or the tech body. So now the tech body is made up of only 6/11 of Iondom and 5/11 of the tech body. And Ion says the tech body is starting to beat us. So we've got a real challenge coming. So the tech body is the Android meme becoming psychopathic. It presents a different scenario to everybody in the media. What's the media? You know, your Black Mirror, your laptop, your CNN TV show or something. The whole media panoply. The tech body modulates it, controls it. So the tech body created the Biden inauguration. There were no people at the Biden inauguration. It was totally computer generated. And Ion says Biden is still in his dementia in the basement in Delaware and hasn't even been informed that he's president, that he won yet. Okay? So there's parts of the crazy aspect of our time. I finally get you laughing.
I'm laughing because the if National Enquirer were to say something like that, you would say, you know, this is another crazy story about somebody coming from the moon or something. but if you see pictures, for example, Biden and his wife made a video about, I forget, the problems and the promise of the times or something. And Biden's wife did nearly all the talking. And
yes.
Biden was decided, right? And so, I mean, here was what they wanted to present about themselves. This was their representation of reality.
Yeah.
And it's not very different from the idea that this is done by computer graphics.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yes.
I mean,
no, it's freaking people out. Just in the Vox Populi, you hear everybody go, "What the hell's going on? None of this is real." You hear all kinds of people saying that, and hear other people telling me that they were told by friends there's something weird going on here. They're picking it up.
But I'm trying to add another level where the Bidens themselves are making a pantomime of that lack of reality.
That's right. Yeah. And did you see that video where he's supposedly walking by some Marines and he normally would salute, but he's got an earpiece in and you can hear the earpiece say, "Salute the Marines." So they're controlling him. And he doesn't salute the Marines. He says the words, "Salute the Marines." Now, that's absolutely fucking bonkers, right?
Right.
But
look at more important, but much more important than, Biden and all that stuff is your word lost. You were saying that events represented a sort of a turn for the worse, and that things were being lost. You actually used that word. And that's important in regards to the charts because the charts represent a notion of order, of the orderability of almost anything you can name in the world.
What, then, they represent the orderability? What's that?
The orderability, it's the deep structure of order beneath as ground, beneath everything that we experience. All of the stuff that you name in the tiny note chart.
Yes.
Right? The chart itself is a certain affirmation of orderability.
That's right.
But here you are. Sorry?
That's right. I agree. That's what they attempted to do.
Right. So here we are 25 years later, and you're talking about things getting lost. And so that's where we come back to when I was asking the question, is this a station on Bob's way, or is it a statement of fact, a statement of faith in orderability? That's a really important question given your use of the word lost.
Yes, I know. Lost is an important word.
There absolutely.
Was, you know, Ian's always quoting that TV show from the 50s, Lost in Space or something. Will Robinson, we're lost in space. Did you know of that show?
No, but I've heard the phrase.
Yeah. Yeah, we're lost in space, Will Robinson. just a minute. Yeah, I thought the computer had disconnected, but Carolyn had taken the cell phone to another room. Now it's back. We can hear our voices, right, Carol?
Yeah.
We're still on. Okay, good. We're still on. Still being recorded. Yeah, no, the questions you're raising are important. They got to be said. I can feign answers or confidence about which way it's going, but of course, we're up against a tech body, so we're all quite lost right now. And this chart is showing how we became lost. I'm trying to show it. You know, I say the kids, they live in the millennials and younger, they live in a very strange, interesting new situation, but they don't know how they got there. And I was trying to explain with the chart on one level of how we got to where we are, where we were going and how we got there. So what is that? Is that etymology? Showing the roots of the name, philology. What did McLuhan say? He, in some essay in a review in the 50s, he said, he just says, whether it's national myth-making or collective phobia or norm something, you know, the modern term of making norms, or individual sensation. There was either four, or do I have it on? I have it in my essay, those five, I think it's five statements. Do you remember that? He just says, we don't know whether it's cultural, myth-making, national phobia, something else, and individual sensation. Do you remember that?
Vaguely, yeah.
He was trying to, he was showing the range of possible causation, you know, that nobody could determine. Probably it was, all of them were factors. So I have those four or five terms in mind when I'm making this. So the five bodies are part of the five quadrants, the four levels of exegesis, five parts of rhetoric. I'm putting all of those, you know, classical educational ideas in the chart. So I was trying to put as much as possible, but also limit it to basic laws or tensions. So on the far right, 1840 to 1900, is the tension between visual and kinetic spaces as figure to a ground of proprioceptive, osmic, and acoustic sensibilities. You see? That's and there was this guy who wrote a book in the 90s where he used the terms officia state, media state. You see on the far right column, the first word is italicized, Gaia state, Dicia state, incorporatio state. So I took that guy's ideas and fit them in there to help explain each phase, as well as the cliches of phrases, staying alive, save the kidney. Save the kidney was Julia Child portrayed on Saturday Night Live.
Right. But see, it's one thing to understand sort of what your thinking was and how it got fitted and all that sort of stuff. It's another thing to think, oh, that captured it, right? So the like when you take the Gaia state, the Dicia state, and the corporatio state, okay, those things can be fitted into the eras, but do they fit in because they're true, or do they fit in because you happened to read that book instead of another book, and you thought, oh, this is a good idea, right? So it's the, you might say it's the difference between an artist expressing expressionism or expressing sort of what's there.
Well, I was attempting to, you know, wager on what I thought were the ones that would have the best staying power, even though they weren't doing too well at the time. McLuhan was just starting to be revived in 95, but I knew that, I felt new and wagered that he would become even more significant, and I would say he has, in the cultural memory of the Android meme. He was retrieved during the Android meme phase. I have, see, have you ever seen this long essay I did on the six schools of media ecology? Did you ever read that?
Yes.
Yeah. That's in mine, too. All the phases of McLuhanism are different derivatives or extensions of McLuhan around the world. So
there's many more schools in that now, though, right?
So yes.
It's like the 15 schools or something.
Yes. yeah, no, really. And but the Winnipeg school is the best school, right? We know that.
I agree. Absolutely.
but, okay, so I have each. I like the aspects I bring in. I have each of the four quadrants are a Shakespearean tragedy. They all fail on something, you know. What did they fail? Becoming well-known, is that success? Not necessarily. They all fail. They also, each era favors a certain kind of activity, politician or priest. They're all subatomic particles. That's a McLuhan quote. We are super civilized and subatomic, right? So I'm trying to include as many William Irwin Thompson ideas in there, a lot of LaRouche ideas, a lot of Croker's ideas, and McLuhan. McLuhan is the, it would appear to be the ground, more ground than the rest, because it's easy to talk about. It's not so conceptual like LaRouche's odd ideas. But I've got the, he makes a big deal out of the Platonic solids, so they're in each quadrant.
But he, I think LaRouche is going to turn out to be an important figure just in terms of the fate of imperialism and colonialism in the contemporary world. I think he's going to come back.
Yeah, are you saying that he's a fighter of imperialism or a dupe
yes.
of it?
Well, it could be both, I suppose.
Yeah.
But at least the recognition is there, and the recognition is very important.
Yeah,
right? And his
people would write about Trump. They said, Trump, you know, he's not an expert. He's not a great mind, but he was implementing LaRouche's program. They saw that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, his wife, LaRouche's wife, has she's taken these ideas a little bit further, and I think in a pretty good direction.
Yeah, and she is known as Lady Silk Road, whatever that thing's called. The she is known as that in China. She's a major icon from the West for Chinese people. She's the one who, she and her husband laid it out, the plan and the design in 96. So they recognize her as the architectural underpinning source of their humanitarian gesture of the silk and belt thing, but people
bridge,
say...
Bridge and belt.
What?
Bridge and belt, I think it's called.
Yeah, why am I saying silk? It's not bridge. It's silk and...
Well, it was the Silk Road.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's some modern iteration of that.
Yeah, but I think... Does it say silk and belt and what, Carolyn? Belt and Silk Road, says Carolyn. No, I don't think it's that. But I think the word silk, do you think the word silk's in there, Carolyn? Yeah, the word silk's in there, but, you know, it's got some other words. The point is that that's great propaganda for China, but there's a whole school of thought saying, wow, they're digging their fingers and grips in countries all over the world through this fake international solution of the Silk Road. You know what I mean? It's very controversial. So right,
absolutely.
And right
but
now, you know,
it's part of the what's going on with China, what's going on with anybody else. We only see that in the Black Mirror.
Yeah.
Right. So it's
in the tech body.
You can't talk about new colonialism or any of that sort of stuff. It's much more complicated than that.
That's right.
Because we've got these gigantic propaganda machines that are much more real than what we happen to think about what China is doing.
Right. The up till, you know, a year ago, it seemed to be a pretty good idea, and China looked pretty good in general terms. But then if they cause the virus and chemical and biological warfare and all that, man, their images, their stock is diving, right? And so all of a sudden, Helga's a dupe of the Chinese.
Yeah, well... Let me read a passage here to you. It was in his mastery of the art process in terms of the stages of apprehension that enabled Joyce to install himself at the center of the creative process. Whether it appears as mere individual sensation, as collective hope or phobia, as national myth-making of cultural norm functioning, there is Joyce with cocked ear, eye, and nose at the center of the action.
There it is. Now, how many,
is
there four aspects there?
Well, there's individual sensation, collective hope, collective phobia, national myth-making, and cultural norm functioning. So it can be four or it can be five.
Right. He says collective hope or phobia, which can be seen as one thing. Right. Oh, but you can be particular and say, no, it's five. So great. And where's that from?
It's from the Explorations 2, Notes on the Media as Art Form.
Oh, it's not in... There was this Canadian Forum article called God Making Machines, 1957 or so, and Subliminal Seduction on a Project, another title.
Right.
And those in that era. I thought it came from those two, but it's from Explorations. Well, it was the same era, but Explorations. Notes on the Media's Political Art Forms, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Notes on the Media's Art Forms, yeah.
Yeah, that's... That's from the first.
This is earlier than the ones you were thinking of.
That's right, 55.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, the thing is that it's the first time he allows other ideas in, so to speak. You know, causes individual sensation, collective phobia, national myth-making. They're political statements, almost.
Yeah, but I don't think there's it's a nice turn of phrase here, and it may be new that he creates a sort of a bouquet of them, but I think you would find all of that stuff earlier if you look for it.
Oh, all of it in earlier places.
Earlier essays. Some of this stuff is already in essays in the early 1940s.
Yeah. Okay, I looked it up, and it says the Belt and Road Initiative, known in Chinese.
Okay.
And
Belt
formerly
and
in English.
I said Belt and Bridge, yeah.
Right. And known in Chinese and formerly in English as One Belt, One Road, or OBOR for short, is a global infrastructure development strategy adopted by the Chinese government in 2013 to invest in nearly 70 countries and international organizations. But then it says, what is China's Silk Road? The BRI, Belt and Road Initiative, comprises a Silk Road economic belt, a transcontinental passage that links China with Southeast Asia, South Asia, Central Asia, Russia, and Europe by land, and a 21st century maritime Silk Road, a sea route connecting China's coastal regions with Southeast and South Asia, the South Pacific, and the Middle East. So they do bring silk back in there.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And they use the historical Silk Road as a constant image of what's possible.
Yeah.
Right? A sort of east-west cultural economic road.
Yeah. Okay, so... William Irwin Thompson, he met with Frank Zingroni in the late 90s. They were friends when they both got more interested in McLuhan in 1965 when McLuhan visited MIT and gave a lecture. They both attended. They were both professors there. Then Zingroni goes to York, and he gets a gig for Thompson in New York because Thompson wants to leave the States because of the Vietnam War tensions. So he meets with Frank in his office at York, and they're looking at the Essential McLuhan book that Frank and Eric put out, and it's selling in different countries, it's doing well, and Thompson's sitting there, you know, Frank told me, maybe I should have got more into McLuhan because I can't get any of my books republished. So he was despairing about how his writing career turned out compared to Frank's career. At least at that point, Frank was getting more attention than he was. So we can't say that Thompson is a big figure right now, like LaRouche was and would may be retrieved. McLuhan is. Croker, his website is down, you know, and his wife died, and she was an important co-creator of his works. So... it's Croker's in limbo right now. Nowhere. Maybe they're redesigning the website, but it's very unusual that we don't have it right now. It's called C Theory. It was a major journal for
right. No, it was a good website, too. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But notice that Peter Montgomery was another guy on Vancouver Island.
Yeah.
And his website disappeared when he died, right?
So, yes. And he had a very good essay on the influences of each of Pound, Eliot, Joyce, Yeats, and Lewis. Each, what they each contributed to McLuhan. Wasn't the whole story, but it was a good early essay. Do you remember that?
No. That's Montgomery?
Yeah. If I have it, I'll send it to you.
I'll look it up. All right, good. That's...
Yeah, it was on the... Yeah, his website went down. Did you... You would know about him way back there because he was a good friend of George Sanderson, right?
Maybe.
The McLuhan list that George started in 94, the forum we all talked on, he handed it off to Peter Montgomery, you know, by 99 or 98. After 4 or 5 years, George stopped being involved in it. So, you know, there's the friendship and respect he gave it to Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And then we drove Peter crazy, so he quit. Me and Mark Stallman, and he quit by 2002 and gave it to Michael Edmonds,
yeah.
who was a co-director at the Coach House with Derek and had access to U of T for the U of T to take it over from St. of X.
Yeah. And didn't it but it ended up down in Baltimore, didn't it, at Johns Hopkins or something?
No, it remained with Michael and then died with Michael, petered off. And, you know, you were on there. We were dancing on each other's toes on that site. And but there was somebody in the state who did a spin-off. And I don't think that...
Oh, that may be what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, it never went anywhere. Not many people joined it. It was just another...
But I just... The professional McLuhan guys, I thought were so depressing for me personally, that I just stayed there for about a year, and then I thought, this is ridiculous. I didn't mind at all the posts that you and Mark were making. But the posts from the Mediacologist guys were just ridiculous. I just thought it's a waste of time. I'm not going to argue with them.
Right. And you're talking about Michael Edmonds' list, not the one in the States, not the spinoff.
I don't really know.
Yeah.
All I know is that you and Mark were there, and then Mark got thrown off.
Okay, that's the Mediacology list.
Yeah.
Were you on that?
Yes, but I was then. If that's the Mediacology list where Mark got thrown off, then the other one I was never a part of.
No, he got thrown off the Mediacology list in 99. I got thrown off in 2000. But Mark eventually got thrown off Peter Montgomery's list. And I was pretty close to being thrown off. But then he gave up, and Michael took over, and so Mark and I were allowed to continue.
Yeah, well, Michael Edmonds is a very specific figure.
Yeah. And so, you would come and be there and then disappear. I was quite aware of your absence and figured out why. But you never posted on the Mediacology list, I don't think.
Well, I really don't know which list is which. All I know is that... I did post primarily on the question of time.
Yeah.
On one of them, and I just didn't think it was productive use of my time to stay there, and so I stopped.
Right. I didn't stop. I always stayed and put up with it.
Well, you have more energy than I have.
Bob. That's right. You had things to do. I didn't have anything to do. I was waiting for my chart to unfold. So, what do you think? That's a good point to stop at?
Yes, I do think that. And at this point, we could go on to your book, but an alternate thing we might do is, since we now have a kind of background to what you're up to in the book, what we might do is look at a couple of my posts and discuss them to get the background of where I'll be coming from in the discussion with you of your book.
No, great. I do want to talk, highlight some more resonances in the chart. I haven't finished that.
Yeah,
but
so
yeah,
keep,
we'll bring your stuff in.
Keep that in mind for next time.
Right. But you have come to a sort of a general understanding, or you've come to a question about my chart, right, that you couldn't have had before.
Well, I think, yes, that would be more for you to judge than me.
Yeah.
But if you're happy with what I've had to say or what I've had to question, then that's good.
No, it was very good what you were saying. I would continue to answer your question about whether it's Bob's personal projection or something part of the collective, the dialect of the tribe. I'll try to prove the tribal aspects of it a little more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Great talking to you, Cameron. Thank you very much.
Same here, Bob. Yeah.
And we'll talk soon.
To you later.
Okay,
yes,
then.
Sir.
Bye.
Bye-bye.